If Coolidge secretly hoped that he would be implored by his party to stay on, that never happened. And if it bothered him, he never indicated. All that can be said is that he declined to endorse Hoover or any other candidate on the grounds that people should make up their own minds. He also, at once, looked much more relaxed and even amiable than he had in a long time. Within a couple of days, he was happily allowing himself to be inducted into the Sioux Indian Nation as an honorary chief with the name of Wombly Tokaha, or Leading Eagle. For this ceremony, he was presented with a large feathered headdress, which he proudly donned for photographs. He looked ridiculous, but somehow enchantingly so. The nation was delighted. So high were Coolidge's spirits that 5 days later he cheerfully travelled 23 miles into difficult backcountry to dedicate a seemingly harebrained scheme on behalf of one of the most fantastically obstreperous men of the 20th century. The scheme was Mount Rushmore. The man was Gutzon Borglum. Mount Rushmore was a granite outcrop so off the beaten track that no one had even noticed it until 1885, when one Charles Rushmore of New York happened to pass by on horseback and bestowed his name upon it. The idea for a mighty carved monument there originated with the state historian, Doane Robinson, who saw it as a way of attracting tourists. It would be, as Time magazine epically described it, the largest piece of sculpture ever wrought in the Christian era. The notion was eccentric, to put it mildly. The project had no secure funding and no government support at any level. There was no certainty that anyone could actually carve a mountainside, and the site was unreachable by road, which meant that people would struggle to see it anyway. Just one man on earth had the necessary skills and experience to carry out the project, but he was also one of the most hot-tempered, quixotic, and maddening individuals ever to grasp a jackhammer. He was also, as it turned out, the perfect choice. In the summer of 1927, Gutzon Borglum was 61 years old. Nearly all the details of his life must be treated with a certain caution, since Borglum liked to change them as time went along. He occasionally awarded himself a new year or month of birth, and frequently claimed achievements that were not his to claim. In his Who's Who entry, he declared himself an aeronautical engineer. He was not. Though born in Idaho at Great Bear Lake in 1867, he sometimes claimed, for no evident reason, to be from California. He listed two different women as his mother, though there was a certain justification for that. His father, a Danish-born Mormon, had married two sisters. One gave birth to Borglum, but then withdrew from the family, and the other sister raised him as her own. Fiery-tempered and barrel-chested, he was pathologically pugnacious. "My life," he once reflected, "has been a one-man war." Borglum grew up mostly in Nebraska. As a young man, he worked as a machinist and apprentice lithographer, but then decided to pursue an interest in art. He took lessons from a woman in Los Angeles named Lisa Putnam and eventually married her, even though she was 18 years his senior. Together they moved to Paris, where Borglum trained as a sculptor. One of his teachers was Auguste Rodin. Borglum lived in Europe for 11 years before he abandoned his wife and returned to the United States, where he quickly established himself as a sculptor. During the First World War, and evidently from out of nowhere, Borglum developed an obsession with inefficiencies in the aircraft industry. Without encouragement or authorization, he conducted inspections of several factories, during the course of which he actually uncovered some significant failings. President Woodrow Wilson asked him to write a report, and on the strength of this, Borglum secured an office in the War Department building in Washington, D.C. Eventually, Borglum made such a nuisance of himself that Wilson dismissed him, even though he actually held no position to be dismissed from. When the war was over, Borglum persuaded the United Daughters of the Confederacy to let him carve a tableau 400 feet high and a quarter of a mile long into the face of Stone Mountain near Atlanta, to celebrate the heroism and bravery of the Confederacy. Stone Mountain had certain resonances. It was where the Ku Klux Klan was reborn in 1915. Borglum was a member of the clan himself for a time. With financial support from the United Daughters, Borglum undertook a great deal of preparatory work, but eventually he fell into dispute with the women and departed abruptly in 1925, leaving behind stacks of interesting sketches and unpaid bills. The Daughters had him charged with malicious mischief and 2 counts of larceny, but by this time Borglum was already in South Dakota, where Doan Robinson had invited him to come and have a look at Rushmore. For Borglum, it was love at first sight. Rushmore had a noble profile and durable surface. Geologists estimated that it would erode at a rate of no more than 1 inch per 100,000 years. In fact, this estimate proved to be true only in parts. Borglum would have to resort to a great deal of ingenuity and adaptability to realize his dream. The budget was set at $400,000, which included a fee for Borglum of $78,000. In addition to the sculpture itself, Borglum envisioned a monumental hall of records cut into the cliff behind the president's heads, reachable by a grand staircase from below. It would hold the Declaration of Independence and Constitution. Sculpting a mountainside was much more a matter of engineering and pyrotechnics than of artful chiseling. Most of the features were magically blasted from the rock. Even the most delicate finishing work was done with pneumatic drills. The ambition was staggering. The 4 faces that greet the visitor today are each more than 60 feet high. The mouths are 18 feet wide, the noses 20 feet long. You could insert a car lengthwise into each eye socket. The possibility of a miscalculated blast turning one of the presidents into a noseless sphinx kept interest high, and the fact that Borglum looked and acted at least slightly mad and was always difficult to work with ensured constant press attention. In fact, mistakes did happen. Jefferson's nose developed an ominous crack, so the face had to be reset at a different angle and many feet further into the stone. Finding sufficient runs of good stone was one of the biggest challenges. The orientations of the 4 heads, each looking in a different direction, Jefferson tucked almost impishly behind Washington, was dictated by the availability of workable stone. Most of Washington's face is about 30 feet in from the original surface. Jefferson's is twice that. Altogether, Borglum and his workers removed 400,000 tons of rock to create the heroic tableau. The greatest problem was financing. The frugal legislature of South Dakota declined to appropriate a penny for the project. Private contributors proved only slightly more generous. In consequence, the project often came to a standstill. In the end, most of the money came from the federal government, but even so it took 14 years to complete the job, about twice as long as necessary in terms of just getting the work done. Among those donating money were Charles Rushmore, now a wealthy lawyer in New York, who sent $5,000. For his subjects, Borglum selected Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and, to widespread consternation, Theodore Roosevelt, who was chosen, it seems, not for his greatness, but because he and Borglum had once been chums. On the day of the dedication, all this lay some way in the future. A road was now under construction, but wasn't anywhere near finished, which meant that the audience of about 1,500 people had to trek 2 miles up a steep track to attend the ceremonies. President Coolidge made that part of the trip on horseback. He was dressed in a business suit, but wore his cowboy hat and boots. Upon arriving, Mr. Coolidge impressed everybody by drinking from a community dipper. As part of the ceremonies, engineers laid explosives into the bases of trees lining his approach route and gave him a 21-stump salute. Speeches were made, and a flag was raised, and then Borglum was lowered on a rope onto the face of Rushmore, where he bored some holes with a pneumatic drill. Borglum's brief labors didn't produce anything recognizable, but it did represent the symbolic beginning of work, and everyone went away happy. Borglum and Coolidge got along fine. Borglum intended to include beneath the heads of the presidents a vast inscription called the Entablature, which would encapsulate in 500 words the history of the United States, carved in letters so large that they could be read 3 miles away. At the dedication ceremony, Borglum impulsively offered the task to Coolidge, who accepted with uncustomary enthusiasm. Coolidge gave the matter much thought and effort over the following months, but when at last he submitted his compositions, they proved to be hopelessly unusable. Most read more like preparatory notes than considered text. Here was Coolidge on the Constitution. "The Constitution, charter of perpetual union of free people of sovereign states, establishing a government of limited powers, under an independent president, Congress, and court, charged to provide security for all citizens in their enjoyment of liberty, equality, and justice under the law." The entablature proposal was quietly dropped, to Coolidge's supreme annoyance. But in the summer of 1927, all that was in the future too, and the president and Borglum parted great friends. Back at the Game Lodge, waiting on Coolidge's desk on his return from Mount Rushmore, was an appeal for clemency for Sacco and Vanzetti. He ignored it. Charles Lindbergh's tour continued. On August 10th, he flew into Detroit, where Henry and Edsel Ford took time off from designing and testing the new Model A to go up for short spins in the spirit of St. Louis, an honor accorded few others. Although the Ford Company manufactured planes, neither Henry nor Edsel had ever been up in an airplane before. Because there wasn't a passenger seat, Henry Ford, like all passengers, had to sit on the armrest, more or less doubled up. Back on the ground, Henry boasted that he had handled the stick for a while and looked awfully pleased with himself. Asked by newsmen about progress on the secret new car, Edsel said that things were going so well that it was ready to go into production. It isn't clear if he was being optimistic or deluded, but in either case he was quite wrong. Production was still some months off. After a day off in Detroit, spent mostly with his mother, Lindbergh continued west across Michigan and onwards to Illinois on August 13th. Among those who may well have turned out to watch him pass over, and possibly even join the crowds at Benton Harbor, where Lindbergh made one of his touch stops, were the Anti-Saloon League's Wayne B. Wheeler and his wife and her father, who were vacationing together at the Wheeler's lakeside cottage at Little Sable Point on Lake Michigan. What is known is that that evening, while Mrs. Wheeler was preparing to cook dinner at the cottage, her oil stove exploded as she lit it, and she was drenched from head to toe in flaming oil. Mrs. Wheeler's 81-year-old father rushed in from a neighboring room and suffered a fatal heart attack at the sight of his daughter fully enshrouded in flames. Wayne Wheeler, who had been resting upstairs, arrived a moment later. He stifled the flames with a blanket and summoned an ambulance, but his wife's burns were too severe, and she died that night in the hospital. The shock of the incident was more than Wheeler could bear. 3 weeks later, he suffered a heart attack of his own and died. With Wheeler dead, Prohibition lost its spirit and momentum, as well as its chief fundraiser. Within 3 years, the Anti-Saloon League would be so hard up that it would have to cancel the newspaper subscription at its Washington office. Within 6 years, Prohibition was dead. On August 18th, an act more important than anyone at the time appreciated, both in symbolic terms and practical ones, took place in Cleveland, Ohio, when the last piece of steel framework was hoisted into place on the massive new Union Terminal construction project. There had never been anything quite like it. As well as a spanking new railroad station, the complex incorporated a hotel, post office, department store, shops, restaurants, and a 52-story office building, the tallest building erected in America that year, and second tallest anywhere until the Chrysler Building went up. All the component parts of the project were physically interlinked, something that had never been done before. Union Terminal was as notable for who built it as for what it was. The developers were brothers Oris and Mantis Van Swearingen. Of all the business titans America produced in the 1910s and 20s, none were more extraordinary or are now more forgotten. Born into modest but respectable circumstances in Cleveland, their father was a bookkeeper, they started off as small-time property developers, but they plugged away and branched out into other areas until by the 1920s they were two of the richest men in America. They were also, by a long shot, two of the strangest. No one knew where their odd first names came from. Their parents had evidently just liked the sounds and made names out of them. The brothers were pale and small and inseparable. In the words of their biographer, they were almost wholly dependent on each other. They lived in a 54-room mansion, but slept side by side in twin beds in the master bedroom. They didn't smoke, drink, or stay up late. They were pathologically shy. They took no part in public life and avoided having their pictures taken. They never named any of their projects after themselves. They didn't attend the topping out ceremony for the Union Terminal on August 18th or the dinner afterwards. Oris was 3 years older than Mantis, but was very much the junior partner of the relationship. Mantis essentially ran his life for him, packed his bags, looked after his pocket money, kept track of his appointments. Oris slept a great deal, 12 hours a night was usual. Mantis sometimes rode horses, but otherwise neither had any known interests. They never took vacations. Their estate, called Daisy Hill, spread over 477 acres. The house had 80 telephone lines to keep them in touch with their business empire. Among the other rooms in the house were two dining rooms, where no guests were ever entertained, a gym that was forever undisturbed, and 23 bedrooms that never received a visitor. They had no friendships. The Mantis did eventually fall for a widow named Mary Snow and enjoyed a relationship with her, which he somehow kept secret from Oris. A field on the property was used sometimes for polo matches and more occasionally as an airstrip. According to the brother's biographer, Herbert H. Harwood, Jr., Charles Lindbergh landed there once and gave Mantis a ride while Oris remained on the ground and fretted. But Harwood didn't say when this was. It wasn't the summer of 1927. If Mantis didn't invent the leveraged buyout, he became one of its first great masters. Essentially, the brothers borrowed heavily to acquire a business, then used existing businesses as collateral to borrow and acquire still more. Their business was a tangled network of interconnected holdings, which by the late 1920s consisted of 275 separate subsidiaries. They had so many companies that they struggled to come up with original names for them all. So that, for instance, they owned a Cleveland Terminals Building Company, a Terminal Building Company, and a Terminal Hotels Company. They bought the Nickel Plate Railroad for $8.5 million, but put up just $355,000 of their own money, and all of that was borrowed from the Guardian Bank of Cleveland, which eventually went out of business without being repaid a penny. They had built this colossus with a personal investment of less than $20 million, nearly all of it borrowed. Nobody did leveraged buyouts better than the Van Swearingens. Mantis's real passion, however, was railroads. The industry was incredibly fragmented. In 1920, America had almost 1,100 different railroad companies. Many lines went from nowhere much to nowhere much, either because the towns or industries along the way never developed as expected, or because the original builders never managed to extend the lines to the main metropolises. The Lake Erie and Western ran from Sandusky, Ohio, to Peoria, Illinois. The Pere Marquette wandered confusedly around the upper Midwest as if looking for a lost item. These forlorn lines, orphans as they were known in the trade, were generally pretty easy to acquire, and the Van Swearingens did so with enthusiasm. They loved to acquire railroads. Within 8 years, the Van Swearingens had built up the third largest railway empire in the country. By 1927, they controlled almost 30,000 miles of rail line, about 11% of the national total, with routes stretching from the Atlantic Ocean to Salt Lake City. Along the way, they also scooped up warehouses, ferries, and the Greenbrier Resort Hotel in West Virginia. At their peak, they had 100,000 employees and assets of between $2 billion and $3 billion. Their personal wealth was put at something over $100 million, from almost nothing 10 years earlier. While building their empire, they also quietly, but significantly, changed the world. At a place called Turkey Ridge, outside Cleveland, they built a new town from scratch and called it Shaker Heights. Shaker Heights was the first planned dormitory community in America, and as such it became the model on which nearly all other suburbs were built. In like manner, the Union Terminal complex neatly anticipated the modern American shopping mall. Unfortunately, their empire was essentially an inverted triangle. If any part of it at the bottom failed, the whole mighty edifice would come tumbling down, and that is just what happened. Though they could have no idea of it at the time, the topping out of the Union Terminal Complex on August 18th was in every sense the high point of their careers. When the Great Depression came, they were hopelessly exposed. Their money was nearly all in railroads and real estate, two of the most vulnerable places to put it, and they were grossly overextended in any case. They had bought Missouri Pacific stock at $101, but by the early 1930s, it was trading at $1.50. They were unable to pay off bonds that came due or interest on loans. The Missouri Pacific and the Chicago and Eastern Illinois failed and brought the whole precarious enterprise down with them. In the end, nobody better personified the giddy recklessness and folie de grandeur of the 1920s than the Van Swearingens. The stress and disappointment proved too much for Mantis, who died of heart failure aged 54 in 1935. Aura sat with him for the last 90 minutes of his life. Mantis was conscious, but they didn't exchange a word. Mantis's estate by then was valued at just $3,067.85, half of which consisted of 7 horses. Lost without his brother, Oris died 11 months and 10 days later of heart failure of his own. His estate was worth even less than his brother's. The brothers were buried in a shared grave in Cleveland's Lakeview Cemetery. The gravestone records their names and their dates of birth and death beneath a single word, brothers. Chapter 22. The successful flights across the ocean of the America, Columbia, and Spirit of St. Louis had a galvanizing, if not always entirely realistic, effect on expectations for the future of aviation. Almost at once, people began to dream of ways of converting the summer's heroics into practical actions. In Paris, Charles Levine briefly attracted the attention of reporters by announcing that he would launch a regular passenger airline service between America and Europe and would invest $2 million of his own money in the venture. How he would safely convey passengers in both directions, when no plane was yet capable of a successful westward crossing, was a matter he failed to explain. As with so many Levine schemes, it was quickly forgotten. Edward R. Armstrong, a Canadian-born engineer, approached the problem from the opposite direction. Rather than try to increase the range and load-carrying capacity of planes, his idea was to cut the distances they needed to fly by building a string of floating landing fields, 8 in all, at 350-mile intervals across the Atlantic. These seadromes would each be 1,100 feet long, weigh 50,000 tons, and be anchored to the ocean floor by steel cables. All would have restaurants, gift shops, lounges, and viewing decks. Some would have hotels. The cost of each platform would be $6 million. A trip from New York to London, Armstrong calculated, could be done in about 30 hours. Armstrong formed the Armstrong Seadrome Development Company in 1927 and gradually secured financial backing. On October 22, 1929, he announced plans to begin work in 60 days. Unfortunately, that was the week of the stock market crash, and his financing fell apart. Armstrong continued for years to try to get his plan launched, reducing the number of proposed platforms to 5 and then 3 as planes became more powerful. Eventually, of course, they were not needed at all, and his dream was never realized. But his seadromes did form the basis of modern offshore oil platforms. Armstrong died in 1955. 2 million people a year sailed between Europe and America in the 1920s, so the potential market for air passengers was considerable. From our modern, time-harried perspective, ocean crossings looked glamorous and romantic, but they were also time-consuming, uncomfortable in bad weather, and sometimes seriously perilous. Fog was a frequent and dreaded danger in the days before radar. Most ships had a long record of unnerving near misses. There were many more close calls on the Western Ocean than passengers ever heard about, writes John Maxtone Graham in The Only Way to Cross. Collisions were not uncommon. On July 15th of this summer, just as the Leviathan carrying Bird and his team was sailing nearby, the Holland-America liner Veendam struck, essentially plowed through, a Norwegian freighter, the Sagaland, near Nantucket at 4:40 in the morning. The Sogaland sank quickly with the loss of one life. The vane dam escaped serious damage, and no one aboard was reported injured. It was, nonetheless, a sobering reminder of how dangerous ocean travel could be, for the ships collided in clear weather. For all these reasons, knocking even a day off the crossing was an appealing proposition, which explains how it was that on August 1st, Clarence Chamberlain accepted an invitation from the United States Lines and reboarded the mighty Leviathan with the intention of trying to take off from its upper deck in an airplane. A rickety 114-foot-long runway had been erected to facilitate the launch, but whether that would be enough was anybody's guess. No plane had ever taken off from a ship at sea, and Chamberlain himself thought his chances of success were only slightly better than even. Shortly before his takeoff, someone asked him if he knew how to swim. Chamberlain grinned and admitted that he did not. Happily, swimming proved unnecessary. In a lull between rainstorms, Chamberlain climbed into a Fokker biplane and shot down the creaking runway and into the void beyond with just enough speed and lift to stay airborne. He circled the ship, gave a casual wave, and headed for Teterboro, New Jersey, where he delivered 900 pieces of airmail and posed bashfully for pictures. Inspired by Chamberlain's example, the owners of the new passenger liner Ile-de-France, launched that year, installed a catapult that could fling a 6-passenger plane down a shorter runway and into the air, and for a few years passengers who were daring, wealthy, and in a hurry could reach shore a day or so sooner than their fellow passengers. As August opened, Charles Lindbergh was coming to the end of the second week of his long tour of America. So far, he had had just one hitch, but it was quite a serious one. After Boston, he had flown on to Portland, Maine, but had been unable to land because of fog. He circled for nearly 2 hours, but then, running low on fuel, he had to look for somewhere safe to land. He grew separated from an escort plane and came down on Old Orchard Beach in Maine. Luckily, a man named Harry Jones offered pleasure flights for tourists from the beach. It's just possible that someone had told Lindbergh about this before he took off, in case he did run into trouble. And Jones had a hangar there with tools, which he was happy to let Lindbergh use. Almost at once, a crowd collected as word got round that Lindy had landed on the beach. People crept up to the hangar and watched him working. He never looked at the crowd, nor did he betray the slightest consciousness of an audience, wrote a young woman named Elise White, who was present. By the time Lindbergh finished tinkering with his plane, the crowd had grown so large that he needed a megaphone to address it. He asked the people to clear a space so that he could depart, but instead they pressed forward to look at the plane more closely. And he threw the megaphone down in disgust, related a slightly startled Miss White. This was not the Charles Lindbergh that they had read about. It's easy to understand Lindbergh's frustration. His plane was a sensitive instrument, and the possibility of some witless gawker damaging it was a real and constant concern. The sight of people pawing his plane, or leaning on it, or waggling its moving parts, was naturally horrifying to Lindbergh. He now essentially fled. Within moments of people coming forward, he was in the plane and proceeded with it onto the beach, trusting that people would scatter as he advanced. Luckily, they did. Lindbergh taxied to the far end of the beach, turned the plane into the wind, and raced forward. It moved smoothly over the sand, and in no distance at all, hardly more than 100 yards, it was in the air, wrote Miss White. He tipped and banked and turned swooping low over the beach, then rose like a silver-winged bird against the blue sky. 30 minutes later, he was in Portland and facing new hordes of people whose most earnest desire was to crowd in on him and his beloved craft. It is impossible to imagine what it must have been like to be Charles Lindbergh in that summer. From the moment he left his room in the morning, he was touched and jostled and bothered. Every person on earth who could get near enough wanted to grasp his hand or clap him on the back. He had no private life anymore. Shirts he sent to the laundry never came back. Chicken bones and napkins from his dinner plate were fought over in kitchens. He could not go for a walk or pop into a bank or drugstore. If he went into a men's room, people followed. Checks, he wrote, were rarely cashed. Recipients preferred to frame them instead. No part of his life was normal, and there was no prospect that it ever would be again. As Lindbergh was discovering, it was a lot more fun to get famous than to be famous. His tour consisted of 69 overnight stops and 13 touch stops, where Lindbergh landed long enough to greet officials and say a few words, but did not otherwise linger. He also flew by request over scores of small towns, but only if they agreed to paint their town name on a rooftop for the benefit of other aviators. In communities where he could not land, he dropped leaflets that read, "Greetings. Because of the limited time and the extensive tour of the United States now in progress to encourage popular interest in aeronautics, it is impossible for the Spirit of St. Louis to land in your city. This message from the air, however, is sent you to express our sincere appreciation of your interest in the tour and in the promotion and extension of commercial aeronautics in the United States." It thereupon urged every citizen, as a matter of national urgency, to work for the establishment of airports and similar facilities so that the United States could take its rightful place as the world leader in commercial aviation. From the start, his receptions were chaotic. Excited onlookers and even members of the official greeting parties tended to rush forward to greet the plane as it was still taxiing. This was profoundly unnerving to Lindbergh. He had once seen a man sliced in two by a spinning propeller. Because he had no forward visibility, every landing was effectively blind. At least twice, in Kansas City and Portland, Oregon, he couldn't land at the intended destination because of crowds on the runway, and had to set down on nearby farmland. Elsewhere, batteries of guns fired in salute of his arrival produced drifting smoke that obscured his visibility further. All in all, he faced more dangers flying around America than he ever had on his flight to Paris. To try to keep to schedules, Lindbergh was often driven at high speed along his parade routes, a matter that dismayed spectators and alarmed Lindbergh, since onlookers here, too, were inclined to step into the road for a better look. An entirely typical day was Lindbergh's visit to Springfield, Illinois, on August 15th, where he arrived in early afternoon, having flown from Chicago by way of Mooseheart, Aurora, Joliet, and Peoria. In the 1 hour and 41 minutes he was on the ground at Springfield, Lindbergh did the following. Made a brief speech at the airfield, was presented to about 100 local officials, invited to admire and review the 106th Illinois Cavalry, placed in an open-top car for a five-mile dash past 50,000 cheering people waving flags, laid a wreath at the tomb of Abraham Lincoln, and was taken to the local arsenal, where he was presented with a gold watch and bathed in a succession of rambling, overwrought speeches. Here is a sampling of the florid tribute paid him by Mayor J. Emil Smith. "As he sailed through the silver of that summer dawn, the stars watched with a still delight to see a child of earth so brave riding the air, a comrade of cloud and wind and foaming wave. And as he neared his goal, the sun, the sea, and the huge unfettered spaces hailed him a victor and chanted to him, 'Well done.'" All that made the Springfield stop a little different was its extreme familiarity. This had been one of Lindbergh's working airfields during his stint as an airmail pilot. Indeed, he had chosen the site of the field just 15 months earlier. In conclusion, the mayor announced that they were renaming the airfield Lindbergh Field in his honor, an irony that cannot have been lost on young Charles, since just the previous year, the citizens of Springfield had overwhelmingly defeated a bond proposal to build a decent airfield in the town. That they had any field at all was thanks only to the local Chamber of Commerce, which provided modest funding to give the city the most basic facilities. After his ceremonies, Lindbergh was rushed back to his waiting plane for an onward flight to St. Louis, where he faced more presentations, more crowds, and yet another evening banquet. Lindbergh was under such constant pressure on the ground that he found the flying between cities the most restful part of his tour, and sometimes introduced long detours into his itineraries to give himself some peace. Where he could, over lakes, for instance, or level ground, he often flew just 15 feet or so above the surface, which increased the sense of speed and thrill, but narrowed his margin for recovery to zero if anything went wrong. He was given 2 days a week off, which must have been a blessed relief, but even then he was far from home and constantly in the company of strangers. Charles Levine was now the only Atlantic flyer still in Europe, and he showed no inclination yet to come home. He poked around for the rest of the summer. He traveled to Italy, where he met the Pope and declared Mussolini the greatest statesman in the world. Returning to Paris, he made the papers for getting into a fistfight with a fellow American near the opera. "I never saw the man before, but he insulted me, and I took a crack at him," Levine said. "I used to be a boxer," he added significantly. The cause of the outburst was never explained, but was rumored to involve a woman. Levine also announced plans to fly home with Maurice Druhan, one of the two French pilots whose endurance record Chamberlain and Acosta had beaten in Levine's plane in April. This would present an interesting challenge, since Druhan spoke no English and Levine no French. Levine several times announced takeoff dates, but each one came and passed. Then abruptly, in late August, Levine collected his plane from the hangar at Le Bourget and took off in it. Some hours later, officials at Croydon Aerodrome in London were astonished to see the plane approaching in a decidedly erratic fashion. The Columbia was a famous airplane, so they recognized it at once, but it was obvious that whoever was flying it was either incompetent or incapacitated. This was a matter of some alarm. Croydon was a busy airport, with regular passenger flights to Paris and elsewhere, and controllers had only limited means to alert other aircraft to stay back. The Columbia circled the airport 4 times, once almost crashing into the control tower. Finally, it came into land at a steep and awkward angle and hit the ground so hard that it bounced high into the air again before slamming heavily back to earth and rolling to a halt. Out from it stepped a beaming Charles Levine. It was the first time he had ever flown solo. It transpired that he had traveled 130 miles further than necessary to get there. Levine said he had just had a whim to go up alone. Soon afterwards, however, news reached London that Levine had in fact taken off just ahead of a writ from Druhan, who was complaining bitterly that Levine owed him 80,000 francs in wages. The hangar manager at Le Bourget also reported that he had never been paid. Levine had evidently also failed to tell his wife that he would be leaving her behind in Paris. Their marriage did not long outlast the summer. To avoid arrest now, Levine had to give a formal undertaking that he would never, under any circumstances, attempt to fly over British soil again. Levine was nothing if not irrepressible, and within a few days he announced plans for another Atlantic flight, this one from Cranwell Aerodrome in Lincolnshire, with Captain Walter Hinchliffe, a senior pilot of Imperial Airways. In the days that followed, Levine constantly contradicted himself about whether he and Hinchliffe would fly to America westward over the Atlantic or eastward across Asia and the Northern Pacific. In the event, they didn't go anywhere, and the papers lost interest in both of them. Druhan did eventually get some of his back pay, but didn't have long to enjoy it. He died the next year in a crash during a test flight at Orly. Hinchliffe didn't fare any better. He vanished at about the same time while trying to fly the Atlantic with a female companion. With the Atlantic conquered, attention turned to the Pacific, specifically the 2,400 miles of challenging emptiness that lay between California and Hawaii. In the immediate aftermath of Lindbergh's flight, James D. Dole, a Massachusetts native who had amassed a fortune growing and canning pineapples in Hawaii, announced a new challenge, to be called the Dole Pacific Race, with $35,000 in prize money. Dole's event was to be a proper race, with competitors all taking off at the same time, or as nearly as possible, from the municipal airfield in Oakland, California. The race was scheduled for August, but was overtaken by events considerably before then. On June 29th, two Army flyers successfully flew in a Fokker from Oakland to Oahu in 26 hours. It was an extraordinary achievement. Hitting Hawaii was a real feat of navigation, and the two pilots, Lieutenant Lester J. Maitland and Lieutenant Albert F. Hagenberger, deserved to be remembered. But unfortunately, they weren't even much noticed then, because their success occurred at exactly the moment that Commander Byrd and his team were splashing down at Ver-sur-Mer. 2 weeks after the Maitland-Hagenberger flight, two more pilots, Ernest Smith and Emery Bronte, also flew from Oakland to Hawaii, though only just. Virtually out of fuel, they crash-landed into a tree on Molokai, but somehow emerged unscathed. They had beaten Maitland and Hagenberger's time by 14 minutes. So by August 16th, when the Dole race got underway, the competitors had absolutely nothing to prove. Staging it as a race considerably heightened the dangers. It increased pressure on pilots to take off whether or not their aircraft were fully ready, and then to push those planes to their limits in order to beat others reasonably presumed to be doing likewise. A race, particularly a well-publicized race with a big prize, tended to attract flyers who were more eager than skillful. Hawaii was a tiny target in a vast ocean, and reaching it stretched even the most experienced pilots to the limits of their capabilities. The whole enterprise was a recipe for catastrophe, and catastrophic it proved. Three competitors died in crashes before they even reached Oakland. Another plane crashed in the sea as it approached the Oakland airfield. The two occupants escaped without serious injury, but their plane was lost. Another plane was not allowed to depart after it became clear that the pilot had no idea how much fuel he needed to reach Hawaii and didn't have a fuel tank nearly big enough. It was obvious that several of the hopeful competitors were dangerous to themselves. By the day of the race, the number of planes taking part had been reduced to 8, and 4 of those scratched before takeoff or turned back soon after. Of the 4 planes that set off, 2 made it to Hawaii, and 2 more were lost en route. One of those never seen again was a plane carrying a pretty 22-year-old schoolteacher from Flint, Michigan, named Mildred Doran, who was not a pilot, but simply accompanying others to add glamour and interest for the press. When word got back that 6 people, including Miss Doran, were missing, a pilot named William Irwin took off from Oakland to look for them, but he disappeared too. A great sea search, the greatest in history, it was claimed, was mounted, involving 39 warships and 19 civilian ships, but nothing was found. The Navy reported, a bit sourly, that it had burned 383,550 gallons of fuel looking for lost flyers. Altogether, 10 people died in the Dole race. The whole thing was widely criticized. Byrd called it hasty and ill-advised, and many echoed his sentiments. Despite the disaster of the Dole race, people were suddenly announcing daring and risky flights all over the place. Paul Redfern, the son of the Dean of Benedict's College, a school for black students in Columbia, South Carolina, announced a plan to fly 4,600 miles from Brunswick, Georgia, to Rio de Janeiro in a Stinson Detroiter airplane. Redfern was an unlikely hero. He had been crazy about planes all his life, so much so that he often wore an aviator's goggled helmet, even when on the ground and just going about his daily business. But his academic training was as a musician. His experience as a pilot consisted of a couple of years of barnstorming at county fairs and working as a spotter of illegal stills for the government. The same age as Lindbergh, he was small and slight. He weighed just 108 pounds and had a nervous-looking face, but then he had a lot to be nervous about. He was proposing to fly 4,600 miles, further than anyone had ever flown before, over ocean and jungle, into a realm far beyond the range of reliable maps and weather reports. He packed as if he didn't really expect to make it. He took with him fishing tackle, rifle and ammunition, quinine, mosquito nets, surgical kit, spare boots, and much else that would only be of use if he crash-landed in the jungle. For his short-term needs, he packed 20 sandwiches, 2 quarts of coffee, 1 pound of milk chocolate, and 2 gallons of water. On August the 25th, he took off. Aviation experts, quoted by the Associated Press, said that it would take him at least 60 hours to reach Rio. Before he had even cleared the Caribbean, he was lost, and dropped a message to a Norwegian freighter, the Christian Krogh, asking for directions. The message bounced off the deck and into the sea. but amazingly, a Norwegian seaman dived in and retrieved it. The message said, "Point ship to nearest land. Wave flag or handkerchief once for each 100 miles. Thanks, Redfern." The ship obliged, and Redfern with a snappy wave departed. It was the last anyone ever saw of him, though for years afterwards, missionaries and other visitors to the interior of Dutch Guiana passed on reports of a white man living among the Indians. According to these reports, the Indians treated the man as a divinity because he had dropped in on them from the sky. The white man, it was said, had taken a wife and now lived in contentment with the natives. Several expeditions plunged into the jungle to try to find Redfern. At least two men lost their lives in the quest, but he was never found. In 1938, at the request of Redfern's wife, that is, his one certain wife back in America, Redfern was declared officially dead by a court in Detroit. Scarcely less improbable, but miraculously more successful, was a flight undertaken by Edward F. Schley, a Detroit businessman, and William S. Billy Brock, a cheerful, conspicuously portly former airmail pilot. They set out to beat the round-the-world record of 28 days, 14 hours, and 36 minutes made the previous year by two other Detroit men using airplanes, trains, and ships. But this time, they intended to do it exclusively by air. Schley, the son of German immigrants, had been an engineer for Henry Ford, but in 1922 he left Ford and opened a gas station. Then he opened another. Within 5 years, he had more than 100 gas stations. He also owned a small airline called Canadian American Airways, through which he employed Brock. Schley was 39 years old in the summer of 1927, Brock 31. Brock had already been in the news that summer for dashing by air from Detroit to the Black Hills to deliver a new collie to Grace Coolidge, the president's wife, after her previous pet ran off. Although neither Brock nor Schley had any experience of distance flying, they set themselves the ambitious goal of circling the world in just 15 days. Their plane was a Stinson Detroiter powered by a Wright Whirlwind engine. They took off the day after Redfern, and for the next 2.5 weeks, their exploits gripped the world, largely because they were so constantly and thrillingly operating at the very edge of their competence. They successfully flew the Atlantic, a notable achievement in itself, of course, but had no idea where they were when they got to the other side. Passing over a beach crowded with holidaymakers, they dropped a message asking the name of the locality. A man with a stick obligingly traced the name Seaton in the sand and pointed to a Union Jack fluttering over the promenade. With their location fixed, they proceeded to a triumphant reception in London. They took off from Croydon just hours before Levine flew in, rather more erratically, from Paris. They made their way in stages across Europe to Constantinople before continuing on to Calcutta, Rangoon, Hanoi, Hong Kong, and Shanghai before they were finally forced down by a typhoon on Kyushu in Japan. They had covered 12,795 miles in 19 days, but were still 9,850 miles from home. Bad weather and the daunting breadth of the Pacific made them decide to end their quest while they were still ahead, and they returned by ship to a hero's welcome. The trip took more out of them than they seemed to have realized. At a banquet in Detroit upon his return, Schley got up to speak, read the first 5 words of his speech, and collapsed, as the events of recent weeks caught up with and overwhelmed him. Things did not get better for Schley after that. In the summer of 1929, he was nearly killed when he was hit by a spinning propeller. The propeller struck his head and amputated his right arm at the shoulder, leaving him much diminished. Just 3 months after that, he lost everything in the Wall Street crash. In 1931, his plane, Pride of Detroit, was auctioned by order of the Sheriff's Department as part of a debt judgment. It was bought by a man named Floyd M. Finney for just $700. Schley died in 1969 in obscure poverty. Brock, too, did not fare well. He died of cancer in 1932. And still, people kept flying. In Britain, an unlikely 62-year-old woman, Princess Lohenstein Wertheim stepped forward as yet another figure to attempt the first east-to-west crossing. The daughter of the Earl of Mexborough, she had grown up in London as Lady Anne Saville, but had married, at the rather advanced age of 31, Prince Ludwig Karl zu Lohenstein Wertheim Freudenberg of Germany. Widowed after just 2 years, the princess used her considerable inheritance to indulge a passion for aviation. In 1912, she became the first woman to cross the English Channel by air, albeit as a passenger. Soon after, again as a passenger, she flew from Egypt to France. When, in 1927, a dashing captain named Leslie Hamilton expressed a desire to cross the Atlantic from east to west, she funded the flight on the understanding that she would accompany them. With Lieutenant Colonel Frederick Minchin as co-pilot, they took off from an airfield near Salisbury in Wiltshire. The princess wore a stylish hat and an ocelot coat, as if they were off for cocktails at the Savoy. They were sighted over Ireland and again from a ship about halfway across the Atlantic, but they never reached America, and no trace of them was ever found. At about the same time, a plane called Old Glory, owned by William Randolph Hearst, took off from Old Orchard Beach in Maine, the beach where Lindbergh had made his recent unscheduled landing in the Spirit of St. Louis, heading for Rome. Old Glory was piloted by Lloyd Bertow, the man who had taken out an injunction against Charles Levine in May after Levine failed to provide contracts and insurance as promised. Accompanying Bertow as co-pilot was James DeWitt Hill, and along for the ride as a passenger was Philip A. Payne, editor of Hearst's Daily Mirror. Just 3.5 hours after takeoff, they issued an urgent, unexplained SOS. They were never seen again. A few hours later, two Canadian airmen, Captain Terence Tully and Lieutenant James Medcalf, took off from Newfoundland, bound for London in a plane called the Sir John Carling. They were never heard from again either. Chapter 23. H.L. Mencken called it the one authentic rectum of civilization. But for most people, Hollywood was a place of magic. In 1927, the iconic Hollywood sign on the hillside above the city actually said Hollywood Land. It had been erected in 1923 to advertise a real estate development and had nothing to do with motion pictures. The letters, each over 40 feet high, were in those days also traced out with electric lights. The word land was removed in 1949. Los Angeles in 1927 was America's fastest-growing city, and its richest when measured per capita. The population of Greater Los Angeles, including the unincorporated communities of Beverly Hills and Santa Monica, had more than doubled in a decade to almost 2.5 million. And those lucky citizens were 60% better off than the average American elsewhere. And what accounted for much of that was Southern California's most celebrated industry, motion pictures. By 1927, Hollywood was producing some 800 feature films a year, 80% of the world's total output, plus some 20,000 short features. Movies were America's fourth largest industry, employing more people than Ford and General Motors put together, and generating over $750 million for the economy, 4 times more than was earned by all sports and live entertainments combined. 20,000 movie theaters sold 100 million tickets a week. On any given day, 1/6 of all Americans were at the pictures. It seemed crazy that such a huge and popular business could be struggling, but it was. The problem was that turnover was so rapid that few individual pictures made much profit. Programs were sometimes changed 3 or even 4 times a week, so there was a constant need for more product. Studios were churning out as many as 4 new films a week, a rate that was clearly incompatible with quality. When somebody pointed out to MGM chief Irving Thalberg that it was wrong to put a beach scene into a movie set in Paris, since Paris patently is not on any coastline, Thalberg looked at the person in astonishment. "We can't cater to a handful of people who know Paris," he replied. As audiences became more discerning in where they sat, if not always over what they watched, Theater owners built bigger, more sumptuous theaters in the hopes of coaxing in larger audiences at higher prices. Big theaters began to appear from about 1915, a reminder that while Europe was at war, America was at the pictures. But the golden age of the picture palace was the 1920s. Theaters were built on a scale that was truly epic, with auditoriums that could seat 2,000 or more patrons in an atmosphere of opulence greater than any they had experienced before. People, it was said, went to Lowe's theaters just to enjoy the restrooms. Architects borrowed freely and imaginatively from any culture that had ever built on a grand scale. Persian, Moorish, Italian Renaissance, Baroque, Mesoamerican, Gilded French. Egyptian became especially popular after the discovery of the tomb of King Tutankhamun in 1922. At the Tivoli in Chicago, the marbled lobby was said to be an almost exact copy of the King's Chapel at Versailles, except, presumably, for the smell of popcorn. The problem was that movies alone couldn't fill such a large volume of seats. Theater owners had to provide extra attractions: musical performances, newsreels, serials, a comic turn, perhaps a magician or other novelty act, dance demonstrations, a round or two of a popular game called Screeno. Some of the big theaters spent as much as $2,800 a week on orchestras alone. Increasingly, the picture became a minor feature of the entire package. In 1927, an industry insider named Harold E. Franklin produced a book with a dull title but a worrisome message. Motion Picture Theater Management outlined with clinical precision the grim economics of motion picture screening. Rent on a typical new movie palace took roughly a third of gross receipts, and advertising swallowed up half as much again. Orchestras lopped another 15% off the intake, and live entertainers typically took about 7% more. When all the fixed costs of staff salaries, utility bills, maintenance, property taxes, and so on were factored in, the profit, in even the best-case scenario, could never be more than a sliver of overall takings. Despite the economic risks, indeed folly, of building ever larger theaters, owners somehow persuaded themselves that the answer was to keep doing so. The first half of 1927 alone saw the opening of Grauman's Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, where patrons could enjoy movies from within the sanctum of a faux Buddhist pagoda, the 3,600-seat North Shore in Chicago, whose interiors were a confection of costly rococo, the similarly ornate and gleaming 3,100-seat Proctor's 86th Street Theater in New York, and the granddaddy of them all, the vast, bejeweled Roxy Theater on 50th Street at 7th Avenue in New York. Everything about the Roxy was without parallel. It seated 6,200 people. The dressing rooms could accommodate 300 performers. A 118-piece orchestra made every movie a symphonic as well as visual experience. An organ so massive it needed three men to play it provided musical interludes. 14 Steinway pianos were on permanent standby. The air in the theater was cooled and freshened by giant machines in the basement. Drinking fountains dispensed ice-cold water, a thrilling novelty. The Roxy even boasted its own hospital, where, as the literature proudly noted, even a major operation could be performed if necessary. So dazzling was the infrastructure that even Scientific American sent a reporter to write a feature. A cartoon in The New Yorker showed a child in the lobby asking her mother in hushed awe, "Mama, does God live here?" Building the theater was estimated to have cost between $7 million and $10 million. The money came from a film producer named Herbert Lubin, who was effectively bankrupted by the project. But the name and vision came from Samuel Lionel Rothafel, known to one and all as Roxy. A Minnesotan, Rothafel grew up in Stillwater, 20 miles east of St. Paul, the son of a shoemaker, and was headed for a career in professional baseball when he was unexpectedly sidetracked, through a romantic entanglement, into movie theater management. He quickly distinguished himself as a showman with a particular gift for rescuing troubled operations. The idea of combining movie presentations with live shows was a Roxy invention. The most notable fact about Roxy himself was that he didn't actually like movies. He lived in an apartment hidden above the theater's five-story high rotunda. The opening of the new Roxy was such a momentous occasion that President Coolidge and Vice President Charles Dawes both sent congratulations, though Coolidge, in his predictably odd way, praised Rockefeller for some equipment he had donated to the Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, and never mentioned the new movie theater. The new Roxy took in $127,000 in its first week, but such business could never be sustained. Footnote: a little noticed fact was that the Roxy was sold almost at once to the Fox Film Company for a whopping $15 million. The purchase contributed significantly to Fox's bankruptcy in the following decade. The New Yorker, in the Talk of the Town column in the summer of 1927, noted that just three New York movie houses, the Paramount, the Roxy, and the Capitol, offered 70,000 seats a day. While the picture houses were struggling to maintain their audiences, things were not going terribly well on the production side of the business either. The previous November, unions representing the craft trades, painters, carpenters, electricians, and the like, had secured something called the Studio Basic Agreement, which granted them important and costly concessions. The studios were now terrified of being squeezed similarly by actors and writers. With this in mind, 36 people from the creative side of the industry met for dinner at the Ambassador's Hotel in Los Angeles in January 1927 and formed a kind of executive club to promote, but even more to protect, the studios. It was a reflection of their own sense of self-importance that they called it the International Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, elevating the films from popular entertainment to something more grandly artistic, scientific, and literally academic. In the second week of May, while the world fretted over the missing airmen Nungesser and Coley, the Academy was formally inaugurated at a banquet at the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles. The idea of having an award ceremony was something of an afterthought and wasn't introduced until the Academy's second anniversary dinner in 1929. Then came a stunning setback. On July 9th, the Federal Trade Commission ordered an immediate end to the system known as block booking, wherein motion picture theaters were required to take all or most of a studio's output, not just its more desirable features. Block booking had sustained Hollywood for years. Under it, exhibitors might be compelled to take as many as 50 dreadful to mediocre pictures in order to get perhaps two or three more promising ones. The Federal Trade Commission ruling threw everything into uncertainty and left the motion picture industry in the exceedingly odd position of being hugely successful and gravely imperiled at the same time. Something radical was needed to put the movie business back on track. In Los Angeles, a tiny, somewhat ragtag studio named Warner Brothers stood ready to provide it with a novel picture with sound called The Jazz Singer. It is a painful irony that silent movies were driven out of existence just as they were arriving at a kind of glorious summit of creativity and imagination, so that some of the best silent movies were also some of the last ones. Of no film was that more true than Wings, which opened on August 12th at the Criterion Theatre in New York with a dedication to Charles Lindbergh. The film was the conception of John Monk Saunders, a bright young man from Minnesota, who was also a Rhodes Scholar, gifted writer, handsome philanderer, and drinker, not necessarily in that order. In the early 1920s, Saunders met and became friends with the film producer Jesse Lasky and Lasky's wife, Bessie. Saunders was an uncommonly charming fellow, and he persuaded Lasky to buy a half-finished novel he had written about aerial combat in the First World War. Fired with excitement, Lasky gave Saunders a record $39,000 for the idea and put him to work on a script. Had Lasky known that Saunders was sleeping with his wife, he might not have been quite so generous. Lasky's choice for director was unexpected but inspired. William Wellman was 30 years old and had no experience of making big movies, and at $2 million, Wings was the biggest movie Paramount had ever undertaken. At a time when top-ranked directors like Ernst Lubitsch were paid $175,000 a picture, Wellman was given a salary of $250 a week. But he had one advantage over every other director in Hollywood. He was a First World War flying ace, and intimately understood the beauty and enchantment of flight, as well as the fearful mayhem of aerial combat. No filmmaker has ever used technical proficiency to better advantage. Wellman had had a busy life already. Born into a well-to-do family in Brookline, Massachusetts, he had been a high school dropout, a professional ice hockey player, a volunteer in the French Foreign Legion, and a member of the celebrated Lafayette Escadrille Air Squadron. Both France and the United States had decorated him for gallantry. After the war, he became friends with Douglas Fairbanks, who got him a job at the Goldwyn Studios as an actor. Wellman hated acting and switched to directing. He became what was known as a contract director, churning out low-budget westerns and other B-movies. Always temperamental, he was frequently fired from jobs, once for slapping an actress. He was a startling choice to be put in charge of such a challenging epic. To the astonishment of everyone, he now made one of the most intelligent, moving, and thrilling pictures ever made. Nothing was faked. Whatever the pilot saw in real life, the audiences saw on the screen. When clouds or exploding dirigibles were seen outside airplane windows, they were real objects filmed in real time. Wellman mounted cameras inside the cockpits looking out, so that audiences had the sensation of sitting at the pilot's shoulders, and outside the cockpit looking in, providing close-up views of the pilot's reactions. Richard Arlen and Buddy Rogers, the two male stars of the picture, had to be their own cameramen, activating cameras with a remote control button. Filming was done outside San Antonio, Texas. The scale of the production was vast and complex. Whole battlefields were scrupulously recreated on the plains of Texas. Wellman deployed as many as 5,000 extras and 60 airplanes in some scenes, an enormous logistical exercise. The Army sent its best flyers from Selfridge Field in Michigan, the very men with whom Lindbergh had just flown to Ottawa, and stunt flyers were used for the more dangerous scenes. Wellman asked a lot of his flyers. One pilot was killed, another broke his neck, and several more sustained other serious injuries. Wellman did some of the more dangerous stunt flying himself. All this gave the movie's aerial scenes a realism and immediacy that many found almost literally breathtaking. Wellman captured features of flight that had never been caught on film before. The shadows of planes moving across the earth, the sensation of flying through drifting smoke, the stately fall of bombs and the destructive puffs of impact that follow. Even the landbound scenes were filmed with a thoughtfulness and originality that set Wings apart. To bring the viewer into a Parisian nightclub, Wellman used a boom shot in which the camera traveled through the room just above table height, skimming over drinks and between revelers before arriving at the table of Arlen and Rogers. It is an entrancing shot even now, but it was rivetingly novel in 1927. Wings, wrote Penelope Gilliatt simply in The New Yorker in 1971, is truly beautiful. Wings was selected as Best Picture at the very first Academy Awards ceremony in 1929. Wellman wasn't even invited to the ceremony. Despite its entrancing aerial sequences, an affecting story of bravery, camaraderie, and loss, many people went to Wings not to thrill at the aerial acrobatics, but to gaze in admiration and longing at its female lead, the enchanting Clara Bow. Bow was just 22 years old in 1927, but already a Hollywood veteran. Her background could not have been tougher. She was born into poverty in the Bay Ridge district of Brooklyn and was raised by a mother who was frequently drunk and always dangerously unstable. Once, as a child, Clara awoke to find her mother holding a knife to her throat. Eventually, Mrs. Bow was committed to an asylum. Bow arrived in Hollywood in 1923, having won a photographic competition, and quickly became a star. She was universally adored by those who worked with her. She worked hard, routinely putting in 15-hour days, and often going from one movie straight into another. She made 15 films in 1925 alone, 35 altogether between 1925 and 1929. Once she worked on 3 films at the same time. Her talent as an actress, and no doubt as a person, was an ability to convey an array of emotions, from demure innocence to shameless lust and back again in a single winsome glance. She danced even when her feet were not moving, the studio mogul Adolf Zukor once said of her. Some part of her was always in motion, if only her great rolling eyes. It was an elemental magnetism, an animal vitality, that made her the center of attraction in any company. Her personal life was rather less successful. She was dazzlingly promiscuous. According to Wellman, during the filming of Wings, Bo had relationships, not all necessarily consummated, but not necessarily not, as it were, with Buddy Rogers, Richard Arlen, a stunt pilot, 2 pursuit pilots, and a panting rider. At one point in the 1920s, she was engaged to 5 men in 4 years. In the same period, she had liaisons with many others. Once, according to Roger Kahn, her boyfriend came home and realized there was someone hiding in her bathroom. "Come on out so I can knock your teeth out, you yellow son of a bitch," the boyfriend yelled. The door opened, and out stepped a sheepish Jack Dempsey. She spent much of the summer of 1927 draped like a wet towel over Gary Cooper, whom she had met on the set of Wings, in which he had a small part as a doomed airman. Bo was originally billed as the Brooklyn Bonfire, then as the hottest jazz baby in films, but in 1927 she became, and would forevermore remain, the It Girl. It was first a 2-part article, and then a novel, by a flame-haired English novelist named Eleanor Glynn, who was known for writing juicy romances in which the main characters did a lot of undulating. "She undulated round and all over him, twined about him like a serpent," ran one typical passage, and for being the mistress for some years of Lord Curzon, former Viceroy of India. It, as Glynn explained, is that quality possessed by some few persons which draws all others with its magnetic life force. With it, you will win all men if you are a woman, and all women if you are a man. Asked by a reporter to name some notable possessors of it, Glynn cited Rudolph Valentino, John Gilbert, and Rex the Wonder Horse. Later, she extended the list to include the doorman at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. It, the novel, was a story in which the 2 principal characters, Ava and Larry, both dripping with it, look at each other with burning eyes and a fierce gleam before getting together to vibrate with passion. As Dorothy Parker summed up the book in The New Yorker, it goes on for nearly 300 pages with both of them vibrating away like steam launches. The motion picture was completely different. Although Glynn received a screen credit for it, the story as filmed bore no relation to anything she had ever written. All that remained of Glynn's earlier effort was the title. In the movie, Bo played the part of Betty Lou, a lively and good-natured department store salesgirl who decides to woo and win the store's dishy owner, one Cyrus Waltham. The movie was an enormous hit in 1927. With Wings, it confirmed Bo as Hollywood's leading female star. She received 40,000 letters a week, more than all the people in a fair-sized town. In the summer of 1927, her career seemed set to go on indefinitely. In fact, it was nearly at an end. Winsome and enchanting as she was to behold, her Brooklyn accent was the vocal equivalent of nails on a blackboard, and in the new world of talking pictures, that would never do.